Hi, this is Dr. Ted Burns. I'm a neuromuscular specialist at the University of Virginia. Today I'm talking with Dr. Henry Kaminsky from St. Louis University and with Dr. Matt Marigioli from the University of Illinois at Chicago. We want to talk today about what we think the patient and family should know about the basics of treatment for myasthenia gravis. There are, generally speaking, two arms of treatment for myasthenia gravis, or three arms if you include thymectomy. One is cholinesterase inhibition, the second is immunotherapy, and the third would be thymectomy. And we want to talk about these treatment options. Henry, how do you decide what arm of treatment to use for your patients with myasthenia gravis?
Well, I think the most important thing is how weak that patient is when they're coming to see me. So let's just take the individual who has severe weakness, has difficulty swallowing, potentially some breathing problems. That individual I'm looking at bringing into the hospital and starting immunosuppressive therapy, usually with prednisone and then adding either a rapid-acting treatment like intravenous immunoglobulin or plasmapheresis. But for the majority of individuals who are coming in symptomatic but not with severe symptoms, I always start on cholinesterase inhibition. I explain this to them, that this is a way to improve the nerve-muscle communication point and get them stronger. I like to do things that way because it provides some improvement in symptoms and starts to educate the patient about the disease process as well as how treatments are managed. So often my patients are going to need to go on to immunosuppressive therapies that actually try to treat the basic autoimmune problem. So that's my basic initial approach as to how I choose between these two arms.
Okay, great. And let's talk a little bit later about thymectomy, but let's break this down a little bit further. The mechanism of action of the cholinesterase inhibitors is different than the mechanism of action of immunotherapy. Henry, would you explain how these are different?
Well, so myasthenia gravis is a disease both of the neuromuscular junction, so the, how well the nerve and the muscle communicate. The acetylcholinesterase specifically allows the acetylcholine that's released from the nerve to increase communication, so to speak, with that muscle, and so the muscle contracts in a much more strong fashion. However, the problem is that myasthenia gravis is caused by antibodies to the acetylcholine receptor primarily that damage the muscle surface. So no amount of improvement in acetylcholine function is going to eliminate that autoimmune attack. And so there you have the need to try to suppress the immune system, and we have a lot of different means of doing that, and decrease that antibody formation and decrease that damage to the muscle.
Okay, so the cholinesterase inhibitors just kind of give a boost at the neuromuscular junction, but don't address the principal problem, which is the autoimmunity.
In my experience, most patients derive some benefit from the acetylcholinesterase inhibitors, but not to the point that they're going to get adequate symptom relief. So nearly all my patients in my career have moved on to receive some immuno-based therapy.
Okay. And Matt, pyridostigmine is the most commonly prescribed cholinesterase inhibitor. What side effects are common and how do you treat them?
Well, the most common side effects of pyridostigmine are stomach cramps, diarrhea, sometimes muscle cramps, sometimes muscle twitching, or what we call fasciculations. My approach to this may be different than many people who use pyridostigmine for myasthenia. Because my main approach to a patient when they develop these side effects is to reduce the dose of pyridostigmine. To me, when you start to have these side effects, it's a sign that that the dose of pyrostigmine is too high. So I have not, in the patients that I've treated, I have not used medications to treat the side effects of pyridostigmine. And in fact, you know, as Henry alluded to, if pyridostigmine is not effective or is only partially effective, I think that's a sign that that patient, that you need to think about using immunotherapy in that patient.
Okay, how about you, Henry?
Well, actually, I agree with Matt's comments entirely. There are agents that block some of the side effects of cholinesterase inhibition, but I don't think, and I certainly do use them, Robinol, for example, being one, or Imodium, but essentially, you're now treating the adverse effects that you've produced, and the big decision is moving on to effective immunotherapy as opposed to trying to chase the side effects of a medication like pyridostigmine that you've given to the patient.
Henry, as you know, prednisone is the most commonly prescribed immunosuppressant used in myasthenia gravis. What are the most common complications of prednisone, and what do you tell patients to do and to watch for when they are on prednisone?
Well, I'll tell you, I think this is among the most important discussions that any physician has with a myasthenic. It's the prednisone has a laundry list of problems that each patient needs to know about and to sign on to when they're initiating treatment. So some of the major ones, weight gain that sometimes can lead to diabetes, worsening of high blood pressure, certainly changes in facial appearance. Nearly all patients with the kind of doses that we give, 60 to sometimes 80 milligrams a day for several weeks to months, patients will have bloating of their face, as well as acne formation. I'll tell you, I think, you know, one thing that to some extent is underappreciated, all my patients' spouses complain that the patient has become more irritable on prednisone and their sleep has become disrupted. That's often a major complaint that I hear about and I ask about all the time. And then in rare cases, severe depression or even mania can occur. So I think all those things need to be explained to the patient as well as the family members or significant others. There's a longer-term complications of osteoporosis that need to be discussed, and in certain situations, often additional medications like vitamin D and calcium and some newer medications to prevent osteoporosis can be indicated. I think it's very important also that they work with an ophthalmologist to look for cataract development or glaucoma, and the patient needs to be aware that these things are going to be occurring, but that prednisone is also an extremely effective medication in the front line of treatment. Rarely there are patients who are not going to agree to prednisone use or really have other conditions that make prednisone inappropriate for at least a first-line consideration.
Well, with that in mind, let's stick with daily immunosuppressants, but let's talk about the steroid-sparing drugs. How do you decide what steroid-sparing drug you might choose and when to choose these other drugs?
So I'll continue with that.
Yeah, sure.
So again, it comes down to the individual patient. Often when I have an elderly patient, so especially if they have comorbidities like a high blood pressure or a family history of diabetes, I'll tend to start another immunosuppressant like azathioprine or mycophenolate early on in the course, within either at the first visit or the second visit. Sometimes it's a little overwhelming to suddenly start a number of medications on one patient. But and I explained to them the ultimate goal is for this to take the place or reduce the need for the prednisone, but it's going to take a long time. In the case of azathioprine, a year or longer even. And in the case of mycophenolate, which is another common agent that I use, at the very least 6 months. So they have to appreciate that this medication is not going to get them better in a few weeks, but it's designed to reduce prednisone over the long haul. I have a bias in that in younger patients, because of the potential increased risk of cancer using azathioprine as well as mycophenolate, that I tend to stick with prednisone alone for longer periods of time in treatment-resistant patients or people who have a couple of exacerbations as prednisone is tapered.
Okay, Matt and Henry, we know that the two randomized controlled trials looking at mycophenolate, which is also known as CellCept, were negative trials, meaning that the drug mycophenolate was not shown to be effective for myasthenia gravis. However, most of us still use mycophenolate in some of our patients. Would either of you like to explain why we still use it if these two trials were negative?
Well, I could address that. I think that prior to the publication of these two trials, mycophenolate was used pretty extensively amongst people who took care of patients with myasthenia. And I think a number of experts who cared for patients with myasthenia became convinced that mycophenolate was effective. So when these two studies were published, there were issues with both studies regarding the design of the study and regarding several aspects of the study that may have affected the results. So the bottom line was that many experts who took care of myasthenia gravis patients became convinced that mycophenolate was effective despite these two published studies. And the explanation was that there were study design flaws, so that it wasn't so much that the studies proved that mycophenolate was not effective for myasthenia, but proved that mycophenolate in certain clinical scenarios was not effective or was no more effective than prednisone. So I think for those of us who continue to use mycophenolate, that's the rationale. Now in the clinic, word about these two studies has obviously gotten out, and I frequently get asked the question, well, should I come off mycophenolate? I'm on it, I'm doing well. Should I come off the mycophenolate? You know, the studies say that it's not, that it's not effective. So for those patients, what I recommend is that, well, since they're doing well, typically what I do is I taper immunosuppression gradually over time. I recommend that we would continue with this plan. If they're doing well, we can gradually taper the mycophenolate over time and see how they do. So I think that's the general approach. I think it's important to make the distinction that the studies don't necessarily mean that mycophenolate is not effective for myasthenia, but it just means that mycophenolate, as it was used in those two studies, is not effective or no more effective than prednisone. And so I try to make patients aware of that distinction. And if they're doing well, my current practice is not to discontinue the mycophenolate, but to gradually taper it over time. Having said that, given the results of those studies, my first-line steroid-sparing agent is azathioprine. rather than mycophenolate. And I'll, you know, all things being equal, when I pick a steroid sparing agent, azathioprine is or Imuran is the first is the agent of first choice.
Henry, what's your agent of your second line agent of first choice?
Well, I still use mycophenolate as my first choice, despite the two trials that suggested, as Matt said, that it, in those particular relatively brief clinical trials, you know, one neither being more than 6 months, that mycophenolate as it was not proven effective. My rationale in that is very much based on the original retrospective studies that suggested there was a benefit for mycophenolate in myasthenia, which then led me to start prescribing it. And then my own personal clinical practice, clinical observations, that patients do benefit from mycophenolate after more than 6 months of use. Certainly, what I would appreciate would be a new study that would be longer in duration to verify my, you know, personal experience. But my personal practice is still to use mycophenolate as a first-line drug. And again, it's all very much a personally driven impression. Also, that azathioprine, when I've used it over the years, patients develop significant side effects, leukopenia, need to very, very close monitoring of white blood cell counts, and you know, then also the, I think, fairly well established cancer risk for taking it for you know, over a decade's time. So you know, that's my rationale. Although, absolutely, as Matt has indicated, that's not completely borne out from an evidence-based approach.
Okay, and I still tend to use mycophenolate over azathioprine, but I certainly don't think there's a right answer and a wrong answer. And as you both know, we recently looked at our experience, and this was retrospective, but we looked at our experience with mycophenolate in myasthenia at UVA and at Duke over the past decade, and we found that somewhere around 2/3 to 3/4 of our patients got to the desired clinical status that we hope for when the patient was on mycophenolate. And this was either mycophenolate combined with steroids or mycophenolate monotherapy. But that it took a while, and Henry, you alluded to this, and it often took more than 6 months. So one of the conclusions of that retrospective study was that these two randomized controlled trials were probably, in retrospect, too short. So we continue to use mycophenolate and seem to be pleased with its efficacy and its safety profile. Henry, over time, how effective are these treatments?
Well, if you look towards the literature first, azathioprine, as you know, has been shown to reduce the need for steroids. Again, in a kind of year or 18-month time frame, and that was done in a very rigorous controlled trial. We've talked again, and there's a number of retrospective studies support azathioprine use, and as you just mentioned, the mycophenolate use. So both of those agents, which I think are the primary immunosuppressants used in the United States for myasthenia, show that patients get better on them. And that certainly has been my experience with both those drugs over time, that patients can go through a very rough first year with myasthenia and somewhat second year, but that our drug therapies and our therapies in general are pretty good at getting patients back to a very good baseline, albeit with the adverse effects of the medications that we use. So what I usually tell a patient is that it's a nasty disease. You need to know about the many aspects of the drugs and how severely weak you can become. But with appropriate treatment, over a year's time, we can get you on manageable doses of prednisone and significantly stronger. Is that the case in everybody? No, but in general, I'd say 80% of patients fall into that good category.
Matt, will you briefly talk about the use of intravenous immunoglobulin and plasma exchange for the treatment of exacerbations of myasthenia gravis?
Sure. So in general, both plasma exchange and intravenous immunoglobulin, or IVIG, are used for the treatment of myasthenia when a relatively quick response is needed, or where the physician can't necessarily wait for 4 weeks for the 4 or 5 weeks for the results of benefit of prednisone, or certainly not the 4 to 6 months for the benefit of chronic immunosuppressive agents. So in general, these treatments are used when there is either what we call an acute exacerbation, or a sudden worsening of weakness in patients with myasthenia, or when the weakness is potentially dangerous. So in other words, when people are having significant swallowing difficulties, significant trouble with their breathing, symptoms that if they get significantly worse could result in a dangerous situation. So obviously the prime indication for using IVIG or plasmapheresis is a state called myasthenic crisis. And myasthenic crisis is when your myasthenia gets, when the weakness from myasthenia affects the breathing muscles or the swallowing muscles to the point where either a patient can no longer breathe on their own, or they need to have a breathing tube placed to protect their airway. So obviously in this situation, in order to get the myasthenia better quickly, one of these two treatments is used. In general, there's some evidence to suggest that in that particular situation, plasma exchange may be more effective than intravenous immunoglobulin. And it's my personal practice to use plasma exchange in myasthenic crisis, preferably, unless there's a reason not to use plasma exchange in myasthenic crisis rather than IVIG. So then the other situations are when you need a quick response, a quick improvement in clinical status, and the other situation where that comes up is sometimes in preparation for surgery, and in particular in preparation for thymectomy. So when patients have significant swallowing weakness or breathing limitations, we will give a course of plasma exchange or a course of treatment with IVIG prior to this surgery to ensure that the patient gets through the procedure safely. Now, finally, the last sort of clinical situation where you might consider giving one of these two treatments is with a significant exacerbation of myasthenia, meaning a sudden worsening or a significant worsening that's occurred over days or weeks, where you want to get the patient stable as soon as possible. So in that situation, what I've used mainly IVIG in that sort of clinical situation to get patients stable relatively quickly. And there was a recent study that was published about a year or so ago that showed that in fact IVIG used in that sort of scenario with worsening myasthenia was in fact effective compared to placebo. So there is support for the use of IVIG in that sort of clinical scenario. Now, there are certain situations where physicians may use IVIG on a serial basis. And obviously IVIG, and by that I mean IVIG every month or every 5 weeks or every 6 weeks or something like that. And it's obviously used in that sort of way in other autoimmune neuromuscular diseases. And in certain situations, and at least for a period of time, say for 4 months or 6 months, that strategy of treatment, giving IVIG every month or every so often, is appropriate in someone who's very unstable, who needs to sort of get over the hump until their other chronic immunosuppressive medications kick in. However, using serial IVIG treatments, or this, you know, treatment every 4 weeks or every 5 weeks over a long period of time probably isn't the most effective way, certainly not cost-effective way, to manage myasthenia. And hopefully, for the long-term management, some of the other more chronic immunosuppressive medicines can get the disease under control.
Great, and I'm glad you mentioned thymectomy. Henry, do you mind introducing the concept and the rationale for thymectomy?
Sure. So thymectomy has been around as a treatment for myasthenia dating back to the late 1930s. The rationale there is that the thymus is one of the parts of the immune system, and in myasthenics in particular have been abnormalities, enlargement of the gland, and certain formations of immune cells in the thymus that are not found in normal individuals. And if you take the thymus gland out of patients, there's been it's appreciated that the amount of acetylcholine receptor antibodies go down. And there's been a number of retrospective studies, and all done very differently, that suggest that patients who have their thymus removed do better. So they're either on lower doses of prednisone or they have higher rates of going into remission. There was a landmark study that was published about 10 years ago now that tried to put all these studies of thymectomy together, and the conclusion from that was that thymectomy might benefit patients. So it wasn't a ringing endorsement, and we know it's not a cure. And I certainly have had patients that have had a thymectomy and still have very difficult myasthenia gravis, and by the same token, I've had patients that seem to do extremely well after having a thymectomy. So with that background, right now there's a study funded by the National Institutes of Health of the United States to try to determine whether thymectomy plus prednisone benefits patients more than using prednisone alone. And it'll probably be several years before we have the results of that. And then to further complicate things, there have been advancements in surgery that allow some surgeons to take the thymus gland out with a very small scar versus the large splitting of the breastbone that has been the standard way to remove the thymus gland. So now there's also some controversies about how effective these new surgeries are in removing the thymus gland. Just to note, the thymus is not like the liver, that is a one spot, a very discreet place in the body. The thymus tissue is distributed behind the breastbone and sometimes up into the neck. So it's very difficult necessarily to assure that all the thymus tissue is removed. I guess to summarize all this, thymectomy right now is usually recommended for individuals probably below the age of 60 and older than 18 in general, sometimes in younger kids, depending on the exact situation, a thymectomy might be recommended. But it's been used for a long time. Many experts feel that it is a very effective treatment. But because we're doing the study, there's not a clear consensus about whether it really helps in light of modern treatments. So one thing, about 10% of patients have a thymoma, an actual tumor within the thymus gland, and there's no controversy. The thymoma has to be removed, and at the same time, surgeons should remove the remainder of the thymus gland.
What I tell patients is there is about an 80% chance that they will improve on prednisone, and that if they're going to improve, it almost always begins within the first month of treatment. What do you tell your patients about the likelihood of improvement on prednisone, particularly in view of the side effects of prednisone?
Well, I tell them something very similar to what you just said. The number is probably around 80%, and I tell them that we will give it 4 to 6 weeks before we decide before we assess the effectiveness of it. They're going to need to be patient. I tell them that almost all, a high percentage of patients will experience side effects, but the side effects are all related to the dose and the length of time you're on that dose. And so the rationale is to use higher doses to get your disease under control and lower the dose to keep it under control, and define what the minimum dose is required to keep it under control. When it's all said and done, as we alluded to previously, the majority of patients do well eventually. It's that, initial period where, maybe that initial year where it's an adventure in some patients in terms of determining which combination of medications they'll respond to. But eventually, the majority of patients really do quite well.
Well, thank you both, Henry and Matt, for your time today, and thanks to the MGFA for sponsoring these educational podcasts.